This week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
We don't have cold beverages, we don't have water, we don't have ice. Most of our trucks here don't even have fans in.
And they're actually expecting this guy on a day that's brutal outside to keep those numbers up, and they want to discipline him over it. This is the kind of thing I'm talking about with these companies exploiting workers, and they're out of control.
Teamsters struggle to keep safe in the midst of temperatures up to 130 degrees in their trucks.
Would the Chilean right have been able to do what they did without the United States? They trained these Chileans on how, with the coup and a clean slate, right, because they wiped out everybody whose name they knew, that they could impose this harsh regime and there was no one left to fight it.
The Chilean 9/11 was a coup made in the U.S. and supported by the AFL-CIO through the American Institute of Free Labor Development.
What's happening in the hospital is chronic short staffing. We do not have enough nurses to take care of our patients.
I've been a nurse for more than 30 years. I've never seen staffing as short as it is now. We're working harder than ever, and the patients are higher acuity than ever, and we're not getting our meal breaks and our rest breaks, which we really need.
Life and death for patients and nurses at Kaiser in San Francisco. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt from Houston's KPFT. There is an explosion of organizing on Labor Day this year. Tens of thousands of young workers at Starbucks, Amazon, and many other places are organizing, building unions, and striking. Unions have the support of the masses of people in the United States for the first time since the 1960s. One of the reasons for this is how workers were treated during the COVID pandemic. The pandemic, now combined with inflation and an unprecedented heat wave throughout the U.S. and the world, is threatening lives. We spoke with the UPS Teamsters from Las Vegas, Georgia, San Antonio, and New York about what life is like in their trucks. As we learned, it is a living hell.
Our brother Gilbert Guerrero from San Antonio, Texas, local 657. We got our brother Mo Nuhaley. He's from Las Vegas, Nevada, local 631. And then our brother Donnie Henry. So Atlanta, Georgia, and myself, Tony Rosario, here out of New York City. Good old Big Apple.
Welcome all. We're glad that we can have this panel here to really find out the nitty-gritty of what's really going on for UPS drivers and other workers who are going out in really a heat wave that we've never seen in our lifetimes. And it's threatening the lives and people are dying. Anthony, why don't you kick it off and talk about what is going on as far as trying to survive for Teamsters, for UPS drivers in this basically catastrophic heat wave that people are going through in this country and around the world, actually.
Well, I'll go on a little bit, but I know my brothers up there have a lot more to say on this. They really work in some really hot, hot areas. Here at Local 804 in New York City, we've had the serious heat wave. We do have, you know, the nice change of seasons and everything like most places, but we had, because of the, you know, New York City is known to be what heavily populated, the pollution, the air. So we're really feeling the effects of the heat, especially when we get these heat waves that are over 100 degrees. And the people here on the channel know anything that's outside is at least triple in the truck. So if you're looking at 100 degrees in your truck, it's easily, you know, close to 130. We've had a few incidents. I'll mention a few real quick. One, we had a driver in Local 804 a couple of weeks back during the heat wave, feeling very sick, feeling cramping, feeling dizziness, and he calls the supervisor. The supervisor says to him, don't call an ambulance. I'll be right there, which, you know, a veteran driver would have been like, sorry, but I'm calling an ambulance right now. You could come get this truck. But this driver, he didn't know that, you know, he didn't know any better, and he waited. Supervisor took about an hour and 20 minutes to get to him. Really bad shape. He said, don't worry, I'm going to take you to an urgent care. He takes the driver to an urgent care. As soon as they got to the urgent care said, get him out of here. He needs to go to a hospital. So that was a complete waste of time. This kid's life is holding in the balance here. And this supervisor's, in my opinion, and I'm sure in the opinion of many others, taking this guy's life for granted. He ends up going to the hospital. And of course, they have to give him IVs. He's hospitalized. He spends the next 2 days in the hospital. And, you know, finally coming back, thankfully, he was able to get the treatment that he needed. Another incident, driver's on the phone, same kind of symptoms. Thankfully, he was talking to his father on the phone. Father says to him, is everything okay? He's like, no, Dad, I'm not feeling good at all. He's like, well, let me know where you are. And the guy basically nodded out. And thankfully, he was able to tell his father where he was, and he was able to get to him in time. He was able to call 911 and get an ambulance there in time to save his son, who was also hospitalized and treated. It's just out of control. There's drivers being disciplined. I can show you a grievance when I have a chance of a steward that actually put in a grievance because they're disciplining a driver for his production. So you're giving a guy a grievance for production, and the steward said to him, but on this day in question, it was over 100 degrees outside. And he's like, well, he still has to keep up a standard of production. He was OJS 7 years ago. So we're talking about a seven-year-old OJS, which is an on-job supervision when they go on the road with them. 7 years ago, they had him at these numbers where he was doing a certain amount of stops per hour. And here we are a couple of weeks ago on a hot day, and they're actually expecting this guy on a day that's brutal outside to keep those numbers up, and they want to discipline him over it. This is the kind of thing I'm talking about with these companies exploiting workers, and they're out of control.
Thank you, Anthony. So any of you others?
Right here, Gilbert with 657 here in San Antonio. We recently had a driver here. He had a ride along about 2 or 3 weeks ago. He was out delivering in the heat. And out here, these drivers have been recording it to be between 130, 140 degrees in the back of these trucks. And he was out delivering with a filling well, starting to feel lightheaded. I might have a little bit of the story a little off, but they were he was delivering to the customer. And I told him, hey, man, you're not looking well. He's like, you know, I'm pretty much, he's like, yeah, I'm not feeling him too bad, but you know, I'm making through it. Well, he starts walking back to his truck, throws up. He gets into his truck, gets in the driver's seat. Again, he has a throw up. Well, when he leans out of the truck to throw up, he falls out of the truck head first, ends up breaking his neck, broke his nose, if I'm not mistaken, and also split his lip. And they're able to get to the hospital. But I think, in my opinion, if he didn't have that ride along, you know, I mean, who knows? Maybe how long he'd been sitting on that asphalt, you know, cooking with a broken neck. I mean, because you can't, when you break your neck, I mean, everybody knows you got to really watch, you know, do you need to take care of your health before you start taking care of this company? And but again, I mean, the main thing is this heat. And they're not, in my opinion, taking that seriously. They're more concerned about their production.
Mo or Donnie?
Yes. This is Donnie out of Georgia, local 728. About in 2019, we had a driver who was also one of my alternate stewards. He goes and runs 4 hours of his route, brings the route back in the truck. And now this is in the summer. I think it was pushing 100 degrees. And, you know, in Georgia, we have this beautiful thing called humidity. So it could be 90 degrees and then that humidity hits and all of a sudden it's 105, 106. And it's sticky and you can barely breathe. No, you can pour water on you, but you're already sweating enough. You really don't want to get any more wet than you already are. So it's about 100 plus out there. And he comes, brings the truck back because he's out of DOT. And they said, no, we have a driver here. You're going to jump in the truck as a helper to get these packages delivered. And they're going to drive the truck. And he said, no, I'm out of DOT. I've worked 60 hours this week. I'm tired. I'm done. He even specified, I do not feel safe going back out on that truck, even as a helper, because of this heat and the fact that I've worked 60 hours this week. They said, well, if you don't go back out, that's job abandonment. So he goes back out, and within an hour and a half of just being back out in that heat, being in that truck, still going into the back of the truck, he passes out going down the steps, kind of similar situation to Guerrero. Passed out going down the steps and just lost consciousness. They sent him to a local hospital Thankfully, they sent him to a local hospital. And he was in that hospital for about 2 days, just constantly getting IVs taken to him.
It seems if somebody is in a very bad shape and is worried about going out, to actually order somebody to go out and then have something like that, shouldn't they be held accountable?
You would think that the on-road supervisor and that center manager that forced that driver back out would have been held accountable. But actually, that on-road supervisor got promoted to a center manager, and that center manager got promoted to be a labor manager. You know, go figure. UPS management messes up, they just get promoted. We mess up, we get terminated. There's been countless times I feel I'm a steward in my center, and I constantly field phone calls from drivers. Man, it's hot. What do I do? I can't. I feel like I'm having a heat stroke, or I feel like I have heat exhaustion. One thing I always tell my brothers and sisters is go find a local fire department on your route. They know what to do. They know the signs of heat exhaustion. They know the signs of heat stroke. I just hate the fact that I have to piggyback that with, make sure you punch out for a break. You know, as if the last thing on your mind when you're having a heat stroke or you're suffering from heat exhaustion is, oh, let me grab my diet and let me punch out for a break. It shouldn't even come to that every day they're suffering from heat exhaustion, from heat stroke. They're, you know, they don't have enough water. And because we have this lovely two-tier wage system, you know, we have drivers that may not have enough money at the end of the week to purchase water. The company's not even supplying us with that water. You know, we have ice machines that are barely usable. You know, by the time all the drivers actually get there, some of the ice machines are out of ice. And now we have to go out there, and now we either have to buy ice or we have to find some somewhere. And we don't have cold beverages, we don't have water, we don't have ice. Most of our trucks here don't even have fans in. So there's not even a slight way to cool off in the cab of the truck, because they don't even have, some of these trucks don't even have fans. And I don't know if you guys have ever been to Georgia, but Georgia in the summer is no joke.
And Mo?
I got a story about a guy that just passed out a couple weeks ago. Actually, it's probably been about a month now. He was about an hour and a half from our hub. He was delivering out to, what you would call a rural route. And the city doesn't have ambulances that would go over there. So while he was delivering, there was another driver that had seen him and had called it into a supervisor and told him, hey, this guy's not looking too good. So I think about 45 minutes or an hour later, she seen not many stops had got done. So she had asked the driver to go back and check on him. Once the driver got to him, he called her and he said, he's done. You need to call an ambulance. He was like, there's no way that this guy could keep going. She called the driver. He wasn't thinking straight. And he was like, no, don't worry about it. I'm just going to drive the truck back. And luckily, she was smart enough to tell him, don't drive. Just stay where you're at. We're calling an ambulance. When the ambulance got to him, it was a volunteer ambulance because it was so far. Las Vegas ambulances wouldn't go get him. So the volunteer ambulance had to go pick him up and then start driving down the freeway towards Vegas to meet a Vegas ambulance so they can swap him out. They basically said he was too far out. But as soon as the volunteers got to him, they hooked him up with IV, and they said his body ate the IV immediately as soon as they hooked him up. That's how bad he was. And then he did end up getting hospitalized that night as well. Just yesterday, I think it was only 102 over here, and I sent Anthony a picture of my thermometer. 149 degrees in the back of my truck yesterday. And like I said, that's low. We get all the way up to 120. You know what I mean? I can only imagine how hot the back of my truck gets. And back when it was 115 to 120 every day, I had a problem with my management team because I kept telling them, it's getting too hot to be in the back of my truck. As soon as I touched the side of my truck, it would burn me. And I would stop delivering for 20 minutes at a time. And I told them, I'm not delivering. I can't touch my dolly. I can't touch my cart. I can't touch my truck. Everything's too hot. They ended up putting a manager to follow me one day. And he got on car. Once he got there, once the cart got so hot, I was like, hey, I'm done. I said, I'm waiting until it cools down. I pushed it to a shaded area. And the manager looked at me and said, wear gloves.
And they have monitoring equipment cameras. These companies are monitoring workers more and more. What they do, why don't they have temperatures in the truck? When it gets too hot, you see you don't work. I mean, couldn't they do that? I mean, hook the trucks up for heat?
They absolutely can do that, but they won't because they don't care. What they actually did for my truck, like I said, I'm in the big brown truck. They actually installed a camera dead center of my windshield. And I brought the union, I brought the safety co-chair, and I brought the mechanics to show them. I'm like, when I get to an intersection, it blocks some of the cars. I wrote it up as a safety hazard, and the mechanic said they're not allowed to touch it, and UPS is saying they're leaving it in no matter what. So, and they won't install fans. I think about 80 to 85% of our trucks don't have any fans at all, and probably the 10% that work, we have 5% that just have fans that don't work, and they won't install any at all.
Those were four Teamsters from around the country talking about their struggle to keep safe in the midst of temperatures up to 130 degrees.
Hey, we going on strike. We going on strike. For real. We going on strike. For real. Till they get this right. Come on. We going on strike. On strike. We going on strike. Okay. We going on strike all night till they get this right. Look, come on. We going on strike, so you better listen. We ain't about to keep working under these conditions. Facts. Working in a hot plant with no air conditioning. And they got the nerve to tell us that this fair conditions. Yeah, right. They don't work they off, they gon' get fired. Facts. Temps working like slaves and don't get hired. Come on. The supervisor don't care if they get tired. They just trying to make sure them sales get higher. The union gotta stick together, do this for each other. Do this one for all my sisters, do this for our brothers. Cause they trying to treat us wrong, but they say they love us. Real. We need a change right now, we ain't going further.
Yes.
We going on strike.
Strike.
We going on strike.
For real.
We going on strike.
Tonight.
Till they get this.
Fact.
We going on strike.
Strike.
We going on strike.
For real.
We going on strike.
Tonight.
Till they get the right. Woo.
We're going on strike by GMAC Cash. This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. On September the 11th this week, there was another catastrophic event that most Americans know little about. A U.S.-supported coup took place in Chile that brought in dictator Augusto Pinochet and restructured the economy under University of Chicago economist Milton Friedman and the Chicago Boys. This coup was also supported by the AFL-CIO through the American Institute of Free Labor Development, AIFLD. Retired University of Indiana Professor Ruth Needleman was in Chile prior to 1973 doing interviews, and she spoke with Pacifica about what happened.
And I have given many presentations, including a battle recently with the Labor and American Working Class History Association for them to put out a resolution asking AFL-CIO to open its files. I did write a 100-page manuscript on AFLD, on the labor movement in Chile, the history of it, and all the things that happened, which I never published. I had a dispute with some people over whether I could criticize the Communist Party. And I felt, because I was an anti-revisionist, pure and simple, that you had to expose them. It was the Communist Party that advocated bringing the military into the government. That's how Pinochet became part of the government of Allende. They also agreed to work with the military to raid every factory commando to make sure no one had arms. And they went out of their way to make sure the working class was disarmed so the military wouldn't overthrow the government. And so the government was saying no to civil war. You can't say no to a civil war that's already being fought. That's putting your head in the sand and disarming everybody. And so part of what I wrote also pointed out some of the weaknesses, and also some of the impossible contradictions. Would the Chilean right have been able to do what they did without the United States? The United States played such a major role, funded the military, provided the equipment for the military, funded all the right-wing attacks, assaults on the government, and they kept getting worse. And so can a peaceful road to socialism work anywhere as long as there are capitalists in power? My conclusion as a young, naive, stupid girl was no. There could not have been a peaceful road to socialism. The U.S. would not have allowed it. And they're still pretty clearly not allowing it because of what they did in Bolivia, what they do in Venezuela, what they've done in every country in the hemisphere and in Africa and Asia as well. In Chile, key economists were sent up to study at the University of Chicago School of Economics with Milton Friedman. They were teaching radical free marketism, meaning that all regulations, all government intervention have to remove so the market can work its magic. And they trained these Chileans, including the brother of the past president of Chile, on how, with the coup and a clean slate, right, because they wiped out everybody whose name they knew, that they could impose this harsh regime, and there was nothing, no one left to fight it. And so there is a movie called Los Chicago Boys that actually is filmed in the 60s and 70s that shows all these Chileans studying at the University of Chicago. And Milton Friedman created the model for neoliberalism in Chile in 1973. They destroyed every structure. They ended the pension system. They ended social, they privatized everything. The vast majority of Chileans lost whatever retirement they had because it was all privatized and they couldn't afford to buy it. Plus, the numbers of people murdered, it's impossible to have an accurate figure. They just recently found hundreds of bodies in a mine. And there's a photographer who took pictures of the discovery who were hoping to show at the gallery in Chicago next year on the 50th anniversary. But they put people into concentration camps. They tortured. And really, you can look at the Disaster Capitalism book by Naomi Klein, the first couple chapters, to understand how they used torture that they knew did not work to terrorize people. And there's a fellow up here in Chicago who was a student leader in Chile. He was arrested. His parents were put in a concentration camp with his two-year-old son. He was sent to three different concentration camps, tortured, exiled to Europe, where he led the resistance. He now lives in Chicago. But the terror was so immense. They tried to do what Orlando Sine said, kill anybody connected to the Popular Unity government, so there would be nothing left to reorganize. And because Meany and everybody who came after him make it clear, they have no problem with capitalism. The only question is how much do we get? And I have all these quotes where they talk about this. They are so clear, so outspokenly public, because they feared nothing. The pillars of neoliberalism are three: privatization, deregulation, and outsourcing of jobs. Now the United States is a victim of Milton Friedman and the University of Chicago. And I will do my darndest, but I'm not very powerful, so I don't know how to go. But I will call for a protest at the School of Economics next September on the 50th anniversary of the coup.
That was Professor Ruth Needleman, the foremost expert on the AFL-CIO and the U.S.-supported Chilean coup on September the 11th.
Por cantar, ni por tener buen amor. Canto porque la guitarra tiene sentido y razón. Tiene corazón de tierra. Y alas de palomita, es como el agua bendita, santigua glorias y penas. Aquí se encajó mi canto, como dijera Violeta, guitarra trabajadora.
You are listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Florida is ground zero for the attack on teachers and public education. Ruth Beltran of Pacifica's affiliate WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, brings us this story.
For some time now, Florida has been actively working to alter the course of public education, dismantle and privatize it. They have passed laws that are turning classrooms meant for learning and expanding the minds of our youth into boxes that confine and construct inquisitive minds. From the Don't Say Gay Bill to the Stop Woke Act, we have seen a steady decrease in freedom to teach and freedom to learn. We have witnessed math books being pulled for reasons that are fabricated by politicians, and books being yanked out of schools for being about our LGBTQ community. Our teachers are being censored more each day, and their methods of teaching are becoming more and more regulated every year. This is the next prong in the attempt to control public education. Florida recently had a teacher training to introduce changes to the civics curriculum standards, and it has left many, many teachers extremely concerned. Standards are always changing, which will be discussed later on this evening. But the most concerning aspect of this training was the training itself. The training utilizes methodology that was developed by Hillsdale College. Hillsdale College is a very small Christian private school, conservative, that supports a white wing conservative political perspective. The training is heavily focused on the role religion had in the foundation of our nation, and it aims to stifle the creative voice of the teacher and instead focus on rote memorization. Politicians have always controlled what teachers are teaching, but the alarming result of these trainings is that now they are aiming to control how they teach. Education is the foundation of our democracy. It is the core of our nation. When you control the education of a populace by dictating the information they're learning and how they're learning it, you control the people.
This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I am Ruth Beltran. You just heard from Angela Nguyen, community organizer with Support Our Schools in Tampa Bay, Florida. Our teachers are being censored more each day, and their method of teaching are becoming more and more regulated each year. We are joined by Brant Robinson. Brant has been a teacher of African American history and world history at Dunedin High School right here in Florida, Tampa Bay area, and he has been teaching for over 25 years. Welcome, Brant, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much. I am so honored and privileged to have the opportunity to speak with you.
Let's begin by giving listeners a real understanding of the situation that teachers are facing in Florida.
Just like all of us, we teachers have sacrificed throughout the pandemic, and we're really proud of what we've done for our students. You know, our public schools have been attacked as part of a coordinated, deliberate method to undermine the integrity of our public schools. Where we are now is an attempt to really demean the integrity of public school teachers with false accusations that we're trying to, quote, indoctrinate our students, or that we're using the false issue of critical race theory, or even more sinister, that we're somehow trying to groom our students simply by virtue of teaching our nation's history or creating welcoming environment spaces for our students, whether they be LGBTQ+ or straight students. I assure your listeners, we're not doing anything differently than what we've always done.
So why the attacks on teachers now?
It's nothing new, but I think that what the pandemic did is it kind of ripped the scab off and it revealed how badly corroded many of our institutions are. I think as more white Americans began to question the breakdown of other institutions, they were more receptive to examining systemic racism and they wanted to learn more about our nation's history. The backlash against that, this is part of an intensified, well-coordinated effort to attack public school teachers. Governor DeSantis, he's using this hollow mantra of parental rights to do so. And there are many teachers that are leaving the profession because of it. You know, too many of us have probably thrown around the word fascism in the past, but the fact is what Governor DeSantis is engaged in is classic fascism and accusing people of indoctrination and questioning the legitimacy of media. It's so, so dangerous to the foundation of our democracy.
What do you feel should be the correct response of teachers? What should communities do?
Educate each other, organize effectively, not only within our ranks, but then also reach out to the general public to educate them, to remind them that our public schools have always been open. A recent NPR poll from earlier this year found 75 to 80% of the public said that they are satisfied with their child's public school. They're satisfied with their children's public school teacher, and they're satisfied with what's being taught. And what that means is that the vast majority of Americans actually value public schools. A wide swath of that 75 to 80% are not politically engaged. They're not empowered. So what we have to do is stand up and defend our public schools from people that would like to use public schools to actually indoctrinate students.
People around the country are not understanding the truth of what Florida is facing today. This is what we are doing. We are bringing that truth. But given that it's Labor Day weekend, tell us a little bit about how teachers feel as workers. What is the spirit in classrooms right now?
I feel like I can generally speak for most teachers when I say that there's always been a morale problem. One of the most devastating statistics in public education across the country is that almost half of all teachers don't make it to the fifth year of their profession before they leave. We have to empower the public to show that they really do care about public education enough so that when teachers like me are attacked, they will be the first ones to come to the table and say, no, we don't believe that. We don't accept that. We defend our teachers and we defend our public schools.
We will always need teachers. You know, there will not be a time when we do not need teachers because teachers are teaching our next generation. So it's just very unfortunate that our government is focusing on that when the majority of the public wants to support and are standing in the corner of teachers.
We really need your help to stand with teachers so that we can continue this effort to counter the misinformation, miseducation that's out there. We have to make sure that we, you know, defend public education.
Brand, thank you so much for taking your time to educate the public and the entire nation regarding the difficult situation that teachers are facing in the attacks at the hands of fascists and white supremacy.
Yes, thank you so much for the opportunity. It's been my privilege and my honor. And I just want to say thank you to all the listeners out there. You guys stay informed, be well. And you know, if you ever need to reach out to me for anything, I'm always here to help. So thanks again, Ruth.
Thank you. And yes, we'll continue to bring information from Florida. I mean, we know that we can count on you, Brent. So thank you so much.
That was Ruth Beltran, who produces The Ruthless Truth at Pacifica affiliate WSLR in Sarasota, Florida. a classic by Isaac Hayes, Cafe Regios. Welcome back to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. The Kaiser HMO is a supposed nonprofit that covers millions of U.S. workers. In California, there has been strikes of engineers, behavioral health therapists, and now 22,000 nurses are also working under an expired contract. They rallied and spoke out this Labor Day weekend at the Kaiser Hospital in San Francisco about the dangerous conditions caused by the lack of staffing by Kaiser management. They spoke to Pacifica about their concerns.
Cheryl Madsen. I'm a nurse at Kaiser in San Francisco. What's happening in the hospital is chronic short staffing. We do not have enough nurses to take care of our patients. It's a very unsafe situation in the hospital. It's basically all you need to know is we do not have enough nurses to take care of our patients. It's a very unsafe situation. The problem is that nurses are worried about their license because it is so unsafe in the hospital. And it's not so much that they're getting blamed, it's just frustrating. It's just that there's not enough nurses to take care of our patients. We are not getting our rest breaks, we're not getting our lunch breaks, we're not getting our meal breaks.
Isn't that required under the law?
It is required under law, yes.
Is it being enforced?
It is not being enforced.
We're supposed to enforce it. Isn't the state supposed to enforce it?
That's what I've been told.
You're worried about the safety of your patients.
I am absolutely worried about the safety of my patients. What ends up happening is that there's patients who, like, let's say they need to be taken to the bathroom. We don't have enough people to safely get them to the bathroom. So what ends up happening is that patients will fall or, you know, have an accident.
This is in a hospital.
Yes.
This is in this hospital.
This can happen. Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yes.
So you're saying patients are falling. Is that recorded?
Could be. Yeah. Oh, of course. I mean, yeah, there. I couldn't tell you the number or when, but that does happen because we don't have enough people to take care of our patients.
My name is Mary Jo Moosney. I'm a nurse in labor and delivery. I have worked in labor and delivery for this is my 45th year. And the problem is almost always not enough staffing, inadequate staffing. But we're all dedicated to give our patients great care because that's what is important to us. As nurses, you want to make people well, feel better, or if they can't be well, you want to help them through their situation. We can only do that with adequate staffing and proper equipment. So that's why we're out here. When you walk in the unit in the morning, you almost immediately know, you can feel it. There's either enough nurses there or there are not. And there is the ability to correct this because in the years past we had a standby system and if we needed another nurse within 30 minutes, she was at work, ready to work. And we need these kind of things. And we need cohesiveness in our staffing. We need core nurses to be together and be able to come to work right away if they're needed. So this can be fixed, and it needs to be fixed.
Kaiser executives, CEOs, are paid millions of dollars, and yet they don't seem to be held accountable for the fact they can't provide services or adequate services.
I'm afraid this is big business in the USA, and we need to change it. It needs to be changed.
You think it should be public health care?
Yes, I do.
How would that change it?
Because the profit will not be the motive. The good patient care will be the motive. We'll take the profit out of it.
But they call themselves a nonprofit.
It's not true. Because the profit side made $14 billion, I believe, yes, last year. And that's only the side that has to show their profit. We don't know how much they made on the side that doesn't have to show their profit. It needs to change. It's a real crisis.
It's Sharon.
Why are you out here?
Because I'm a nurse and we need safe staffing now.
How long has this been going on, the issue of staffing?
Like for years, decades, years.
If management knows about it, why haven't they had safe staffing?
Because they don't care, you know? They want us to suffer, you know? And it's not good because we can't take care of our patients if we don't have, you know, we don't have staff. I had to write an incident report on Saturday because one of the doctors wanted me to take a patient on the chair. And I'm like, I would love to, but I don't have any staff. And there's 300, the patient was 360 pounds, and there's only one of me. And I'm like, I can't, you know? And I had to write an incident report against it.
My name's Dolores Flanagan. I've been a nurse for more than 30 years. I've never seen staffing as short as it is now. We're working harder than ever, and the patients are higher acuity than ever, and we're not getting our meal breaks and our rest breaks, which we really need. We need to have nurses that are part of the community, not contracted traveling nurses that are working beside me, making twice as much money I am, but that aren't invested in the community.
Your union has supported public health care, single payer. I mean, it seems like
absolutely.
The issue of
a lot of people wearing the slogan on their backs.
And how would that change the care and the situation at Kaiser?
It takes away the financial incentive, because if the single payer health care that's provided and funded by the government, it takes away the incentive to make a profit because of the level of the playing field.
So it would be better for the patients.
Yeah, much better for the patient. It's better for the whole world, because if you have preventive health care readily available to all, you have a healthier patient population, a healthier public health population.
How were you affected by COVID in the pandemic? Did you have enough PPE?
No, we did not have PPE. I was threatened with discipline because I brought PPE from home to wear, and I got called into the manager's office on a Sunday morning and told to take my mask off or go home.
Take your mask off.
In March of 2020, March 25th, 2020, it was already well known that this was an airborne virus. I was told to not wear my mask. And when I asked why, they said, well, what would the patients think if you're wearing a mask?
Malfeasance.
It's immoral. So that's the definition of a moral injury that we carry. You know, when people say that nurses have burnout, I think you could substitute the word betrayal. What nurses have is betrayal.
And you think it's going to change?
I believe it can. I believe we're going to bring the change. We have to bring the change. The center cannot hold the way that it is. And, you know, nurses are always going to be devoted to patient care. Patients are always going to be there. Our population is aging, so there's going to be more of a need for nurses. The vast majority of nurses right now are over 50. And we need to make nursing an exciting, attractive opportunity for young people to get into. So we need to provide better working conditions for nurses. We need to have nurses there at the bedside to care for this huge gray tsunami that's on our shore right now.
You heard the voices of Striking National Nurses United in California at the San Francisco Kaiser Hospital.
I wear garments touched by hands from all over the world. 35% cotton, 65% polyester. The journey begins in Central America in the cotton fields of El Salvador. In a province soaked in blood, pesticide sprayed workers toil in a broiling sun, pulling cotton for $2 a day. Then we move on up to another rung, Cargill. A top 40 trading conglomerate takes the cotton through the Panama Canal, up the eastern seaboard, coming to the U.S. of A. for the first time, in South Carolina, at the Burlington Mills. Joins a shipment of polyester filament, courtesy of the New Jersey Petrochemical Mills of DuPont. DuPont strands of filament begins in the South American country of Venezuela, where oil riggers bring up oil from the earth for $6 a day. Then Exxon, largest oil company in the world, upgrades the product in the country of Trinidad and Tobago, then back into the Caribbean and Atlantic seas to the factories of DuPont on the way to the Burlington Mills. in South Carolina to meet the cotton from the blood-soaked fields of El Salvador. In South Carolina, Burlington factories hum with the business of weaving oil and cotton into miles of fabric for Sears, who takes his bounty back into the Caribbean Sea, headed for Haiti this time. May she be one day soon free. Far from the Port-au-Prince Palace, third world women toil doing piecework to see her specifications for $3 a day. My sisters make my blouse. It leaves the third world for the last time, coming back into the sea to be sealed in plastic for me, this third world sister. And I go to the Sears department store where I buy my blouse on sale for 20% discount. On my hands clean.
Sweet Honey in the Rock, Are My Hands Clean. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Labor historian Howard Zinn has written about the hidden history of class struggle. He spoke in 1992 at a forum called The Hidden Working Class History of the United States on why class struggle is ignored.
So I thought I would start off with a quotation from a man who is certainly an expert in something, George Bush. Now, I came across this, and not too many things that he says strike me in any way, but this, he said this sometime during the 1988 campaign, and he said, in my view, there's no place in American public life for philosophies that divide Americans from one another on class lines and that excite conflict among them. I mean, that interested me because I thought, well, is it philosophies that divide people along class lines and excite conflict among them? I mean, that's always that's been said for a long time. It's not reality. It can't be reality. It can't be that that's the way the world is. It can't be that that's the way America is. No, it must be that some people are going around with philosophies that introduce this into people's minds, have to tell people that there is a class society here and that there is class conflict here. I suppose at a certain point in my life, I began to veer off in this peculiar direction in which I've been going ever since. And I suppose I guess this happens a lot. People get away from that acculturation, those texts, that inundation of ideas in the culture, and they begin to look very sharply at the reality around them, or to think very deeply about what they themselves are experiencing. And so I guess I had experiences in my life which made me begin to question what I had read in history books about war, about class conflict, about the race question, about lots of things. At the age of 18, instead of going to college, I went to work in a shipyard. I say instead of going to college as if I had a choice. I decided as a sociological experiment to work, yes. I spent 3 years working in a shipyard and experienced, well, that reality, as so many people do, simply the reality of work, the reality of industrial work, the reality of hard work, the reality of working in conditions of cold and heat and bad smells and boredom and work. And then I enlisted in the Air Force, and I became a bombardier in the Air Force, and I flew bombing missions in World War II. I guess I should say which war I was in, so that people won't think it was the Spanish-American War. But and I knocked around various jobs and worked in a warehouse and ditch digger and brewery worker, and then decided to do nice work, get myself a nice job, go to school, study history, which I did under the GI Bill. So by the time I began to study history in this sort of semi-professional way, that's going through the whole history, I already had a set of ideas, I already had a set of experiences, and I knew enough as I began to read the books that were given to me in undergraduate and graduate school, and saw that they weren't significantly different than the books I'd gotten in junior high school. You know, that I discovered that you, very often you get in graduate school the same viewpoint. I mean, what's the point of fleshing out a bad viewpoint? But that graduate school simply repeated the fundamental biases of junior high school on a more sophisticated level and with more complex language. And so in order to learn something about things that I thought were missing from my books, I had to go outside the classroom and I had to read things of my own. And I began with labor history because I just got interested in labor history. I'd been brought up in a working class community and I'd been in a couple of unions. And I was interested that the things I began to read about on my own didn't appear in my books. I didn't see Big Bill Haywood in these texts. I didn't see the IWW. I didn't see Mother Jones. I didn't see Emma Goldman. The few quick flashes I think there were a few lines on the Pullman strike of 1894, you see. Nothing about the Ludlow Massacre, nothing about the Colorado Coal Strike of 1913, 1914, nothing about the Lawrence Textile Strike of 1912. I mean, nothing about the thousands of labor struggles that people in this country have engaged in, you know, all through our history. From the earliest time, from the early 19th century, from the organization of the mill girls in Lowell, and the Lowell Factory Association and the protests and the strikes, nothing about that. And so I had to read on my own very often. They were, you know, not the kind of things that people would assign in courses, but it gave me new viewpoints. I read Howard Fast's books, The Last Frontier, and realized it's possible to have a different viewpoint on the Indians than the one that came across in history courses, where you knew about Custer's Last Stand and about two other little things. And that was it. You weren't told that during the Civil War, the Great War for Freedom, one of the great massacres of Indians took place out in Colorado. I moved the books, the Marx books on my shelf, from one place to another to keep the authorities guessing. But I read Marx, and Marx said that history is a history of class struggle. And everything I read in American history suggested that this was true.
That was Howard Zinn in 1992 speaking about the hidden history of the U.S. working class and how he became aware of the class struggle. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the executive producers of CRD, Akua Holt, Paulina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at Pacifica CRD and on Facebook at COVID, Race, and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.